Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, hi, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of Ancient Future Faith. My name is Chris Alford, and I'm the blessed guy who's the pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento, California. By the way, and as always, we'd love you to come worship with us at the church, and you can find more information by zipping over to the website. It's epiclesis.org. That's E-P-I-C-L-E-S-I-S.org. The program is brought to you each week by Epiclesis, and we talk with guests, from pastors and theologians to academicians and everything else in between. And this week is no exception, and I'm especially proud and happy to have a friend and colleague right here in the Ancient Future Faith studios with me, Dr. Jennifer Harris Clayton. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome.
Hi, Chris.
It is so good to have you here.
It is really amazing to be here in this warm weather.
Jennifer, before we get into everything about you that we need to know, we should say you are on your way through Sacramento, headed up to Seattle, and we might want to tell folks why you are headed. I mean, isn't it chilly up there today?
Yes, it is indeed. Okay. I'm about to finish my training in NLA counseling program for victims of trauma and abuse at the Allender Center, which is housed in the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology there.
How long has that been going? I don't think I asked you before. How long have you been at this?
It's been 4 sessions over the course of about 7 months. So it's been quite an intensive journey.
I was going to say that sounds very intensive.
Yes, but fantastic.
So is it comprised mostly of in-class stuff? I mean, do you have some follow-up exercises and papers and that kind of stuff?
Right. So it's a combination of in-group teaching, lecture style, and then small groups where you get to practice what you're learning and put your money where your mouth is, so to speak, and then outside of class, writing assignments and reading. Yeah.
Well, so in some ways, then, it reminds me at least a little bit of the Institute for Worship Studies where we both graduated from. In fact, that's how we met. I had the great pleasure to meet you and get to know your heart and hear what you were working on in your doctoral class. And we just became instant friends, didn't
instant we? Friends, yes, exactly.
It happens that way sometimes.
It does, indeed.
So remind me, what was your thesis project? I'm not remembering off the top of my head.
Well, I can't imagine why. It's not like you don't read several of dozen a year.
Piles and piles.
Piles. I wrote and implemented a children's worship curriculum at the church. And it was quite interesting to work with the kids, and as it not being my main area of focus, it was quite a joy for me to see them learning and experience, and then culminated in them actually leading worship for and designing and leading worship for Palm Sunday.
By the way, wouldn't it be wonderful if more churches did a similar thing?
Yeah.
I mean, it would change worship, wouldn't it?
It really would.
And maybe we don't lose so many kids if they are actively involved in the designing and leading of worship, especially if it's guided, right?
I mean, absolutely guided.
Sure.
And there was a lot of planning and forethought that went into each piece of it, but it was very interactive. Music and art and drama, and the kids took real ownership, which I think is a key piece to keeping kids in church, to not only be doing it, but to understand why they're doing it.
Folks, you're listening to a conversation with Dr. Jennifer Harris Clayton. She's a buddy of mine and a member of the Ancient Future Faith Network. And Jennifer, just tell us everything we need to know about you. How about that? What makes you tick?
What makes me tick?
Tell us about you.
Well, the things that you usually rattle off in situations like these, you know, have to do with your bona fides or your experiences. I think at this season in my life, the things that are really resonating for me are more questions than answers.
Wow, okay.
And I really am enjoying that process. It's freeing and a little bit scary at the same time, but I feel like God is revealing himself to me in a way in this season that I've never experienced before, which is really exciting. But
scary, too.
And yeah, stripping away a lot of the preconceived ideas that I had, especially growing up as a, you know, the granddaughter of the pastor and a musician in church, and quite literally growing up in the church. And it's a gift and a little bit scary at the same time.
Well, we should say, though, that you were a longtime worship pastor, music minister, and you are still doing that to some degree now. But I sense that part of what you're talking about in terms of more questions than anything right now is that you're going through a kind of discernment phase about calling in ministry and shaping ministry and figuring out what that next step might be. Am I right? I don't want to put words in
there. No, that's a really good way of putting it. There are things that in the past seem to make sense, you know, being the music director, being the music pastor, doing music for church, but it doesn't encompass all of the things that really bring me joy, which is, you know, also includes creating community and hearing people's stories and looking people in the eyeball, which I really like. And as the worship leader, you're not often able to do that personally as I would like. So yes, it's definitely a discernment period to say, okay, God, you know, these are the pieces about me that tickle me and get my juices flowing and the gears turning. So what does it look like to bring them all together into a new thing?
I remember getting a call from you one day. I think it was a year after our initial conversation when we were working through your thesis as you were getting ready to graduate. And you said, hey, I remember us having a conversation that really resonated with me. And it seemed to tie in with some things that God was doing with you at the time. Let's talk first about your heart, your inclination, your longing to minister to the wounded worshiper. And it was the Wounded Worshiper Sanctuary that came out of that. What's going on with that right now?
I think as God is often prone to do, he does not reveal things en masse, but in pieces, bits and pieces here and there. And over the last few years, as education and further growth and personal growth and all kinds of things have happened, different pieces have started to be revealed in terms of what was next for me. Mm-hmm. And while leading worship and music will certainly be a component and a very important component of it, there were other pieces that were singing, so to speak. And so out of that, out of a lot of just quiet time before God and wrestling and lots of questions, this is the Wounded Worshiper Sanctuary was what was born out of all of that.
What were you seeing and what were you concerned about? Mm. What were the bits that were sticking out?
Yeah, I think a few of the bits were being in ministry settings or retreat settings or just places where I was seen as, you know, the teacher or facilitator with people who just felt that they were not able to express the reality of where they were, what was going on in their lives, almost an expectation that they felt, unspoken largely, but they felt from the church and from the people that they were involved with that, you know, if they had challenges or tragedy or difficulties in their life, that it spoke something against them rather than acknowledging that it's the reality of humanity.
Okay, and so you're talking about church staff people.
Yes, largely.
Okay.
That being, you know, my context and the people that I would be hanging with. But even as, you know, in a simple of a setting as a Bible study and listening to, you know, someone who they just go to church, they're not even involved in leadership, but not having a place to really to talk about the challenges. And then my really fun thing to have people over for dinner or, you know, share a bottle of wine together and just really talk heart to heart. And then the music and the worship part of it all just kind of started to come together to create what I later named the Wounded Worshiper Sanctuary.
You, like I, were noticing that there are a lot of folks, particularly in serving ministry, staff, pastors, who are really wounded. And maybe their wounds have been self-inflicted, but many times it is the church or the process of working at church that wounds folks. And then you also saw, well, obviously there are other people who are lay people or folks who are just coming to worship who are also wounded. And we need to really somehow focus. I think it's pandemic, by the way. I think it's far larger than anybody realized. What were you noticing that these people didn't have a platform to speak or no one to acknowledge that pain? Or
I think the ability for people to name what has happened to them is a key piece, but also to receive acknowledgement and affirmation that what they have named is true is true. So I can name it for myself and know it to be true, but to have someone to come alongside me and say, I affirm you in that. I believe you that this is what happened. I am standing with you. it's a huge piece to releasing the shame and the hiddenness of it, particularly for those of us who serve in church. You know, there is, in my opinion, an unhealthy expectation of perfection, both from people who sit in the pew, but particularly of leadership, that the mantle of leadership means that they're perfect somehow. And I know that that sounds a little harsh, but how do we start to ask the questions about how to address the humanness that's in our pulpit, the humanity that leads our worship, that teaches our children, that, you know, sings our songs and plays our instruments, that is still part of the glory of God, that while we are still sinners, Christ died for us kind of stuff, that perfection doesn't happen because you step up onto the platform.
Well, and as we were talking earlier, our weakness is the very place where God tabernacles. As our colleague, Dr. Diane Collard, says, sometimes the best art is made when the minerals and the pigments are crushed first. Mm-hmm. So rather than hiding or stuffing down the woundedness, I think that there's a path, isn't there, for God's glory when we begin to acknowledge it and process it and work through it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you take something as familiar as Psalm 23, for example, being someone who subs for the Catholic Church often, I do a lot of funerals, and I sing or play or read Psalm 23 at least 4 to 5 times a week.
Wow.
And
it's in your bones.
It's in my bones.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, you can't get to surely goodness and righteousness will follow me all the days of my life unless you're willing to travel through the valley of the shadow of death.
Yeah, we like the beginning of the psalm and the end of the psalm.
Absolutely. The beginning of the psalm is so lovely. And often a lot of us experience that beginning, you know, the laying down and green pastures and still waters, particularly if our experience with Christ becoming a believer happens later in life. We really can experience that tranquility and that change. But then life starts to throw stuff at us. And what do we do with that? But what does it look like for our faith and for the health of our churches and our worship if we journey together through those dark places, yeah, rather than say they don't exist or pretend they don't exist or shame people who are going through those very places?
Yeah, we sometimes shoot our wounded, don't we?
We certainly do.
And sometimes, especially if they are church staff.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much easier to dismiss a church staff person than to deal with the systemic issues that are part of the problem.
And I wonder what, you know, if we started asking some questions, and again, I'm in a question kind of a place because I feel like I have more of them than answers, but, you know, what would it look like if instead of projecting or demanding or expecting perfection to be more, a little more open about the fact that just because someone zips up a pastoral robe does not suddenly negate their new humanity. What would it look like to embrace the fact that we all have these imperfections, these sins that are inherent in us because of our humanness, but then connect that to saying, okay, well, isn't this a really cool place for God to work his amazing glory?
Mm-hmm.
To say, you know, if this is where my struggle is, could this be the place where God is going to use me most gloriously for his purpose and for his work on earth? Making a staff change is quick and simple in many ways, particularly for those who are left behind because they can just bring in someone else. But what do you do with what caused the problem in the first place? Because half of that relationship is still at the church. You know, one staff member may have left, but the other part of the piece is still there in
You're
the
right.
church. And having been twice now, the comer after of a long time broken relationship staff person, you know, the one that gets to come in and pick up all the pieces, which is such a challenge.
Which you've done twice.
Twice in a row. Lucky me. What would have happened if the problems were dealt with far sooner than when I had arrived? Because what's going to happen is that it's just going to perpetuate itself. It happens over and over again because the problem from the other side is not really addressed or dealt with.
Well, let me say this before we go on. If you're listening to the broadcast and you are a staff member at a church or pastor or have been one and you are wounded from the church, I'd love you to get in touch with me, and I can, and I do this often, talk with you myself or include Jennifer in the conversation, recommend some resources for you, because we have a heart for folks like that, and we really do honestly care. Sometimes looking at those things is not fun, maybe even oftentimes, but there's a wonderful opportunity for reconciliation and restoration there if folks will stick with it. Mm-hmm. You're listening to a broadcast brought to you by Epiclesis, an ancient future faith church in Sacramento, California. I'm Dr. Chris Alford, the pastor of the church, and the host of the program called Ancient Future Faith, brought to you each week by Epiclesis, right here on KFIA Radio. Today, my guest is Dr. Jennifer Harris Clayton. She's a good buddy, and she's passing through Sacramento on her way to Seattle for some, well, are you finishing up this particular time?
Yes, I'll be finished at the end of the week.
Finishing up this lay counseling degree. But in our remaining moments, Jennifer, I wanted just to share with the audience a little bit right now what's percolating in your mind. We had a really interesting lunch conversation, and it involves the themes of woundedness, I think, but you have a really deep concern for folks in church who may be, well, you explain it.
Part of the training process that I've been going through has been dealing particularly with victims of trauma and abuse. And while the program itself and the training looks at those who have experienced sexual abuse, I find that there's an extraordinarily similar overlap to those who have experienced abuse in the church, not even of a sexual nature.
So hold on a second. Let's name that. Mm-hmm. What kind of abuse are we talking about?
Spiritual abuse.
Which might look like what?
That's a hard thing to name because it can be different for everyone. But anything from emotional abuse, mental abuse, and we all know that sexual abuse happens in the church, but just mistreatment of people. And
By leadership, pastors.
Yes, leaders against other leaders, and certainly by church members, but those who have experienced broken trust, boundary violation, any of those kinds of things where they have been made to feel icky. And I know that that's not a real technical term, but it's sort of like that definition of pornography. You can't describe it, but you know when you see it.
Right.
For those of us who have experienced that in the church, we may not be able to describe it for everyone and name it across the board, but you know it when you've experienced it.
Yes, I worked with a church staff member one time, and you couldn't quite put your finger on it, but every interaction with this person, you walk away feeling like you've been slimed.
Exactly.
There's just something about a just under the surface kind of emotional manipulation or something that's going on. It's very painful.
It's very painful, and particularly because it's almost impossible to articulate. And additionally, because it's the leader of the church, often, you know, senior staff, and to make accusation or point fingers or anything like that against those people is a very major uphill battle. And ick, slime, all of that, that is your body telling you that something is not all right here in Camelot. So I remember when I was growing up, there was someone in the church that I grew up in, and I couldn't put my finger on it, but whenever that person was near, I had the urge to flee. And looking now back at what was going on, my body knew what to do in that situation. So it can be anything from constantly putting you down or degrading your efforts or making you feel like you're not good enough, to berating you for results that never happened, or even passive aggressive things like approving things to be done and then at the last minute changing your mind and things like that. It just makes you feel like you're crazy, and you're not. You're not crazy. You're being mistreated. And
it occurs to me to say also, though, that sometimes people feel like they have been wounded or say that they have, and the truth is there's stuff they need to deal with. And so surely part of all of this process is a very careful discernment on how much of this is real, how much of it belongs to that particular person, how many things they need to deal with honestly and soberly themselves, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And part of that process is finding the right people to help walk through that with you. It's rather flippant to say, but it's true. We are all broken people. We are all wounded people because of our human nature. And wounded people wound other people. Part of the work of being leaders, I believe, needs to be that we are in serious self-examination on a continual basis to identify the things in us that are triggered by people and that we can trigger in other people.
Okay, so what are you doing about this? How are you going to fix this?
Right.
So what's knocking around in your noggin right now about, I mean, you said earlier you're asking a lot of questions, but how are you dealing with all of these questions right now? What's God seem to be putting together?
Well, I think part of the process of training, of this training in Seattle, has been to go through the process myself. And while I feel like I'm just beginning in many ways, to be able to look at myself with grace and with dignity and with honor and say, here are the broken places in me. What does that look like to invite God and his healing power, to invite Jesus into that space with his grace and mercy and say, what can you do here? What can happen here? Mm. How can I grow from this place? And let's be honest, there are a couple of things about me that are going to be the same until I go to be with Jesus. But the edges around it, the depths of it and the heights of it, that can change. That can be healed, and the fracture there can get smaller and smaller and smaller as I invite the work of the Spirit into that place. That's also the call, I believe, for every leader. If you are inviting yourself into leadership of people, if you are not inviting that work humbly, with sincerity, without the whole poor me, martyr me kind of a thing, right. But how we invite that work into our life, in my opinion, is a sign of a great leader. Someone who is willing to remain humble, remain teachable, remain movable by the Spirit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to be able to hear when they have hurt someone, to receive it, and then how they respond to that is a significant picture of what a true leader would look like. How they respond to someone when they are hurt. Do they acknowledge? Do they push back? Do they go on the offense or are they on the defense? Mm. All of these things are indicators of their own mental, emotional, spiritual health.
So it sounds like all this isn't all yet together, right? but God is moving in your heart to maybe expand the Wounded Worshipper sanctuary and begin to address some of these things in a ministry that you really do honestly feel called to, don't you?
I really do.
Oh, I sense it.
Yeah. And, you know, when I first started the sanctuary, I was thinking it was going to be, you know, a retreat-based ministry where people would come together and we could talk about, you know, their woundedness and do some work around that. But wearing the worship leader hat for almost my entire life, it's only natural that would connect in my brain and say, well, okay, retreats are great and extraordinarily helpful. Teaching is great, but what about the week in, week out work that we are called to do as ministers in the church? How can we connect these questions to, you know, the pinnacle event of the church, which is weekly worship?
Yeah.
How do we connect that together and acknowledge that there are these issues in each and every one of us?
Well, it seems to me that at least one ancient future thing about what you're talking about is the notion of community. Mm-hmm. And we have gotten away from that so much in the North American church. We have a very much of a privatization of religious experience or worship or inviting Jesus into my slice of life or so on, and not truly wanting to be accountable to others. So it seems to me that if we could recover the ancient future notion of doing this thing called church in community, that's going to be the healthiest environment where we can begin to explore some of these things, yeah?
I completely agree. And I also believe that it can't really happen in a community that is too large, because it's easier to hide.
You bet.
And there are
some people look for that.
Exactly. Frankly, yes. It's a lot more difficult when your church is 12 people to hide some of these issues and pretend that they're not happening. So,
and we naturally want to avoid that.
Of course we do.
Well, Jennifer, it's been delightful to have you with us. I wish time permitted a longer conversation, but let me ask you this. Will you come back again and let's talk about how God is putting this together and what he's doing in your heart in terms of this kind of ministry? Will you do that?
Absolutely. Thank you.
My guest today, folks, has been Dr. Jennifer Harris-Clayton. She's a good friend, a member of the Ancient Future Faith Network, and a colleague of mine from the Institute for Worship Studies. She's on her way to Seattle to finish up a counseling degree, but also has a big heart for folks who have been wounded in the church, both lay and staff folks. Well, folks, I want you to think about this before we gather again, would you? Surely the road to our evangelical future runs through our ancient Christian past. Until next time, the Lord be with you.
Thank you for joining us for another look at Ancient Future Faith. There is a refreshing wind of renewal blowing through the evangelical church as more and more worshipers turn for inspiration to the rich language and pattern of the ancient church, and they're rediscovering classic Christianity and learning to draw strength from a deep well of time-tested truth and tradition. Want to experience Ancient Future Faith for yourself? Join us for worship at Epiclesis in Sacramento on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. in the chapel at 4600 Winding Way. You can contact us by calling 916-572-9113 or online at epiclesis.org. That's 916-572-9113 or on the web at epiclesis.org.
Hey folks, just a minute before you go. Lent has begun, that historic period in the life of the Christian church when we focus on putting things off and putting things on in preparation for Easter. Let me invite you to make worship at Epiclesis a part of your Lent this year. And by the way, folks, our small groups have just launched an intriguing Lenten series called Soul Keeping, and there's still time for you to jump in. As always, get more details on the web at epiclesis.org. That's epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you, and see you next time for another edition of Ancient Future Faith.